Thank you for coming. As he said, I'm going to speak about a wide field of view sensing system that we've developed, although we did it for other purposes, and perhaps I'll allude to those as we go on. All right, so I wanted to cover three things. Most of the work is on the third topic, but the first two I think are worth covering because certainly I think I've got a perhaps unusual perspective from what you might have first imagined. So, first question, why should we do space situational awareness or surveillance of space? I'll use the terms interchangeably. Well, I think it's almost self-evident. There's lots of stuff above us. We need to know what it is. We spend a great deal of effort understanding what the air picture, what aircraft and so forth are, you know, flying around us and near us. And we also need to spend effort in understanding what people have put in orbit above us. So that's the first thing. The second thing is we put our own assets in space, so we need to be able to manage those. We need to know where they are in order to talk to them and for them to do the things that we wish for them to do. There's this notion of a good international citizen. You can imagine a middle power like Australia being able to perhaps provide independent statements about the presence of activities in space and perhaps remind you of the 2009 Chinese anti-satellite test, where at least for a few days it was unclear what had happened, and until China announced what it had done, it was turning into a kind of, you know, US-China debate about what had gone on. So I think there's a real role for, you know, middle powers, small powers like Australia, having something to say about what's going on above us. The next one's launch services. Now, we don't do a lot of launch in Australia, but we do some launch. I've personally been involved in some extent to maybe six or seven launches now. Generally, I'm downrange and the things fly over me, so I'm ever hopeful that they don't fall short. But, you know, you can't put things in space without knowing what's already up there. I mean, it'd be enormously embarrassing, of course, if you put a sounding rocket into the space station by accident. Imagine, you know, explaining that one away. The other one is collision avoidance. There is this question of, as more and more assets go up there, how do you stop them banging into each other? And then that follows on to this idea of Kepler effect and so forth, where you can get this cascading collision debris creation that may render space unusable or difficult to use. So there's the sense that it's a fragile resource. It's one of the commons, like air and water, that we need to preserve in some way, and understanding what's up there is a key part of that story. And then I guess the other thing that, you know, as we start to put CubeSats and all sorts of other things up there, we have to think about what happens when these missions run out. You can't just leave stuff there. You know, we are good neighbours. So there's a whole challenge of end of mission management, including potentially deorbit. So you need to understand what's up there, what your things are doing, in order for you to behave in a reasonable, good citizen type way. And then the final one, of course, is it's just interesting to try and understand what's up there. It's an interesting technical challenge. So let me give you a little historical context. Obviously, satellites, the usual stuff, you know, for communications, for intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, for remote sensing, for navigation and for timing, and general scientific payloads. But I draw you now back to, you know, let's return to the late 50s for a moment. In the early 50s, there was an attempt by the US to President Eisenhower, actually, to create what he called an open skies policy, where you could fly your reconnaissance aircraft over the other people and so understand what they were up to, and that would hopefully diminish the threat of what at that time was increasingly looking like nuclear war. I draw the contrast between Sputnik and the act of trying to fly aircraft over another territory. So trying to fly aircraft over, people are trying to shoot you down. And indeed, we saw that with the Gary Powers shoot down in 1960. But of course, Sputnik goes up 3 years earlier, and everyone thinks it's a great idea. It can fly over your head. No one's trying to shoot it down. And it really creates this difference between space objects freely able to fly above you and apparently with no concern, and air-breathing aircraft flying above you, which you did everything that you could to get rid of. It's worth noting that there is now an open skies policy or treaty for aircraft, but it was created in 92 and ultimately signed in 2002. So, contrast the satellite circumstance. You can put up a satellite, it can fly anywhere. Apparently that's of no concern. We're trying to do the same with aircraft, in which case it's a very difficult thing to do at all. And I think a side part to this is this idea of verification for deterrence. So the idea was you are less likely to start an end of world type war if you have some understanding of what the other people are up to. And so there was this challenge between space objects flying above, attempting to disrupt them, but not really, because in fact they were a stabilising influence. Step now into the idea of what is really strategic defence, or missile defence, we'll call it missile defence. Through the late 50s, early and mid-60s, culminating in probably the early mid-70s, a lot of effort was spent on missile defence. That is the attempt to defeat incoming strategic strike, either the Soviets attacking the US or vice versa. And a lot of technology was developed at that time, which has direct relevance today in this surveillance of space mission. And in fact, what you see is that when you're building sensors for these other roles, most of the time you're actually looking at space objects because they're great calibration sources, they're great testing of your equipment sources, and so forth. So the two missions are coupled tightly. From that work, we got, I guess, two things that I wanted to draw. One was the phased array radar. So that was this idea of an agile, very effective radar for observing what is above the Earth. As I said, you can use it for surveillance of space most of the time. And the other thing was this idea of classes of weapons, in particular nuclear weapons in space. And so the early anti-ballistic missile systems, unlike the ones that you hear about today, were actually nuclear devices. Those operating outside the atmosphere were optimised to generate X-rays to destroy weapons, and those inside the atmosphere were optimised for neutron, like the classic neutron bomb. Now, obviously, that meant that in the late 60s, early 70s, things were becoming very, very difficult in terms of nuclear weapons all over the place, including in space. And we've seen this significant direction of weaponization, although with the Outer Space Treaty in 1967, there was kind of a change in direction and people moved away from that. And I think that was motivated by the recognition that you needed to understand what the other guys were doing, and to disrupt that made things less stable, not more stable. But I want to draw you to the point that all of these things existed in the 60s and 70s, and they're only not there today because of treaty. And so what happens if treaties fail? Okay, so here's another significant application for the need to understand what is above us. So I want to point out, treaties do fail. Look at the anti-ballistic missile treaty signed in 1972, and we see today that 2002, that's no longer in effect because the United States stepped away from it. So they did that, and they did it for a purpose. They've now breached it, not that it's breached because they're obviously not party to it anymore, but they've exceeded its limits in terms of mobility of interceptors, speed of interceptors, and power of the radars that they use to observe the incoming thing. So again, there's this relationship back to sensors for looking as to what is above us. So what does the future hold? Well, more of the same, of course. The future is always more of the same. We're going to see a sophistication in this management of what is in space above us. So rather than integrated air pictures for aircraft and so forth, that's going to extend to include things above 100 kilometres, so this notion of integrated aerospace and missile defence systems. Obviously, small sat, and as I said here, you think drones are annoying. Well, I have a drone, so for those drone people out there, don't spam me. But we're going to see lots and lots and lots of satellites, and that's going to bring its own challenges as well. Australia itself has to become sophisticated in the way it conducts itself in this way, and we're going to see launch services increase in Australia. I mentioned there's been 6 or 7 or 8 launches over the last decade or so. That's going to increase significantly. And there's obviously the fact that I think Rocket Labs, for example, are talking about $4.9 million to insert something into orbit. That's an order of magnitude less than to do so otherwise. But going forward, we've got these difficult notions like countering objects that are in space. So the intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance satellites that are up there, people will attempt to counter them. We're going to see cyber and electronic warfare effects applied to satellites, so attempts to manipulate communications protocols, attempts to damage or blind or manipulate the sensors themselves. We're going to find that satellites are going to have to require some form of self-defence. It's straightforward to place one satellite near another satellite to activate, perhaps for nefarious purposes at any time. We've got to admit the possibility that there will be a weaponisation of space. We've seen treaty failure. I mentioned the ABM treaty. It could happen with other treaties as well. And there's all these technologies that are coming forward that all have application in space. ASAT, anti-satellite, it's an interesting history there. First anti-satellite systems in the 70s. We've seen a range of developments. In the 80s, we've seen ASAT systems launched from aircraft. Russia today has some co-orbital ASAT systems. And of course, 2009, we saw the Chinese destroy a satellite in space. And 18 months later, we saw the US equally destroy a satellite in space. So I guess don't say there's not an arms race.